The late U.S. President Richard Nixon was a control freak, to put it mildly. He worked very hard to keep tight control on his administration, especially the information about it. And the release of information was what ultimately brought Nixon to his resignation. And information continues to surface over the years. A good bit of recently released information about the Nixon White House went into Tim Weiner's book, One Man Against the World, The Tragedy of Richard Nixon. Tim Weiner has been covering government activity for a very long time. He covered war and terrorism in the Middle East and Africa for The New York Times, won a Pulitzer for his reporting on secret government programs, and wrote 5 books, including Legacy of Ashes, A History of the CIA. Tim Weiner, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning to you.
So when you cover secret government programs, is a book about Nixon a natural step?
Absolutely. Part and parcel of my own upbringing, as well as a key passage in the 20th century in America. I'm old enough so that Nixon was my president. He took office when I was 12, and he resigned when I was 18. So his presidency in the Vietnam War, which was raging throughout all those years, really shaped my political consciousness and my idea of government. Probably not a great upbringing if you want to have faith in American democracy, but my faith has been restored throughout my works and years. Nothing stays secret forever in America. Our Constitution is strong enough so that there are no secrets that time will not reveal. So you can write a history of the CIA, and you can write a deep history of the presidency of Richard Nixon now, with all the secret tapes and all the classified documents now out as of the end of last year.
And that's how recently they were out, just the end of last year, 2014?
Yeah, I'll tell you, making deadline on this book was exciting.
Oh, I can imagine. Well, not only that, but I mean, given the number of documents that you cite here, I mean, you could have read these for years, let alone written about them for years.
People will be combing through this material for years on end, but I had a heads up. I had been out at the Nixon Library about 2.5 years ago giving a talk about the relationship between Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI. The Bureau was the subject of my book that had been just published then. And the people who run the Nixon Presidential Library took me aside and said, listen, we know your work. We trust you. We have a wonderful surprise for you. By the end of 2014, everything will be out. And there were 800 hours of secret White House tapes, tens of thousands of pages of documents, including Nixon's and his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman's, personal diaries. And I thought, there's my next book.
Well, was there a gold medal winner, a single document or set of documents or tapes that made you go, aha?
I understood things that were very new to me and deeply disturbing from listening to these new tapes in particular. I really have made a study of Richard Nixon all my life. When I wrote about my history of the CIA, his command and control of the CIA was a crucial aspect of why he fell. When I wrote my book about the FBI, his command and control of the FBI, and his deathbed struggle with J. Edgar Hoover, who had run the FBI for 48 years, was a crucial aspect. But what stunned me about this new material is how deeply unstable mentally and emotionally the president was in times of crisis. He suffered from raging insomnia, which he treated with alcohol. Not a good idea.
Well, yeah, that part of the book in particular is a little on the scary side, because anybody who gets that little sleep is likely to be on the border of psychosis anyway, and then his way of treating it or self-medicating.
And then he picks up the telephone, and it's after midnight, and he starts raging to his closest aides. And this is the most powerful man in the world, you know, and he is threatening to obliterate entire countries with conventional and on occasion even nuclear weapons. He's saying, I want to fire half the FBI, I want to fire half the CIA, I want to fire half the State Department, they're all traitors. And by the end, he trusted no one. And mistrust became mutual, and the American people brought him down.
When he talked about obliterating countries, why don't we just go straight there? I mean, what were some of the places he talked about wanting to do away with?
Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the curses that befell Richard Nixon, that he inherited a war that If you're too young to remember Vietnam, you cannot imagine how terrible it was.
I'm just 3 years behind you. I remember pretty well, myself.
Half a million combat troops at war at the end of the day, and it was a very long day, a decade of combat operations. 58,000 Americans dead. That's more than 10 times the number in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. And an entire country, that's the United States, wounded by feeling the wounds of hundreds of thousands of veterans returning, some of them battle-scarred, some of them heroin-addicted. We have the same problem with veterans today. But additionally, the country was torn apart by the war. Nixon fought it on two fronts. In Vietnam, he could use B-52 bombers, and he threatened on half a dozen occasions to use nuclear weapons to bring the war to an end. At home, he fought his political enemies. Everybody that was against the war and everybody that was against him with a different set of weapons, buggings, break-ins, burglaries, black bag jobs, blackmail, to destroy his enemies politically. And these were ordinary citizens as well as senators and congressmen.
But, you know, the level of paranoia, you indicate that Nixon thought it was coming from elsewhere.
Well, even paranoids have enemies. And Nixon certainly did have enemies in this country on the domestic front. But he thought that the anti-war movement in this country was actually being financed by Moscow, by Beijing, by the international communist conspiracy.
It's a pretty amazing stuff, all contained within the pages of the just-released book, One Man Against the World, The Tragedy of Richard Nixon. Pulitzer winner Tim Weiner wrote it and is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Tim and take your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the Pulitzer-winning journalist Tim Weiner. His latest book is called One Man Against the World, The Tragedy of Richard Nixon. It takes advantage of the release at the end of last year of a whole bunch of information about Nixon and his presidency. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about that time in history. 800-838-3760 by phone anywhere in our listening area, by email anywhere on the planet, jx@jeffnet.org. It's clear when you go back to Nixon's early years that nothing came easy for him early in life. Rough upbringing with a mean father, dead siblings, lousy job prospects. How then did Nixon rise so fast in politics after World War II, Tim?
Anti-communism. He became the leading anti-communist politician in America after World War II. Only J. Edgar Hoover was a more powerful force for anti-communism in this country. And that was the beginning of the Cold War. And Americans were terrified that communism would spread like AIDS or the plague and infect the minds and destroy the American body politic. And it was this fear that drove Nixon into his first elected office in Congress after World War II, propelled him into the Senate after two terms in Congress, and 2 years later, he was running with General Dwight D. Eisenhower for president as his vice president, and they won. And from 1953 to 1961, Eisenhower and Nixon ran the federal government. Then, in 1960, Nixon ran against John F. Kennedy and lost to that young, handsome senator by 117,000 votes. It wasn't quite Bush v. Gore, but it was awfully close.
And he always thought it was a stolen election, didn't he?
He did. But unlike George W. Bush, he decided not to contest it.
Was it simply time that rehabilitated Nixon as a presidential candidate?
No, it was 8 years of relentless struggle by Richard Nixon from the time of his defeat in the 1960 presidential election to the time of his very narrow victory in the 1968 presidential election. Nixon not only traveled the world and met with foreign leaders around the globe, but he went to every wedding, every christening, every funeral, every bar mitzvah of every member of Congress and every conceivable Republican delegate to the 1968 convention over the course of 4 years. He wasn't wandering in the wilderness. He was fighting his way to the greatest resurrection since Lazarus.
You bring 1968, the year of his presidential election, to life in several scorching paragraphs, and anybody who was around at that time can't argue it was one of the worst periods in American history, which raises the question again, how then did Nixon manage to emerge the winner from all this?
Fear. People, the same reason he rose, fear. 1968 was a terrible year, as anyone who is alive will remember. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy, who was running for the Democratic nomination for president, was assassinated, just like his brother before him. Bobby Kennedy probably would have won that election had he not been murdered. American soldiers were dying at the rate of 400 or 500 a week in Vietnam. And Nixon promised, although he offered no specifics, that he would end the war. If the war had ended before the election, Nixon would have lost, and Nixon made good and damn sure that it did not end. He, in violation of federal law, inserted himself into the secret diplomacy to end the war in the fall of 1968 and sabotaged it, sending word to South Vietnam, our allies, not to sign a peace settlement, that they would get a better deal if he were reelected president.
Wow, which is what you describe as an act of treachery unparalleled in American politics.
President Johnson called it, on tape, treason.
And so Johnson knew?
Yes. He found out because we've all become familiar in recent years with the National Security Agency. Back then, it was known somewhat jokingly as Washington. The NSA stood for No Such Agency. It didn't exist officially. Well, they had the presidential palace in South Vietnam, our allies, totally wired. The FBI had the South Vietnamese embassy in Washington totally wired. And they picked up very clear signals that Nixon was in direct contact with the government of South Vietnam, sending this message, do not settle, wait for me, I will get you a better peace. Of course, in the end, he did not. The war went on and on and on and on until Saigon fell and America lost a war for the first time in its history 8 months after Nixon fell.
Let's take a call. We have Bill and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Weiner, the author of One Man Against the World. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thanks. You just answered my one question about Nixon trying to stop the peace movement until he got elected. So I have two other questions. I lived through the Vietnam era. It had a big negative effect on my family and a lot of friends. And I'm curious. I heard that, like, I understand, like, 56,000 Americans died in Vietnam in combat or raided, you know, over there. But since then, I've heard that over 100,000 that served in Vietnam have committed suicide. And my other question is, did Reagan pull some of this kind of stuff against when Carter was president with the hostage crisis, try to make a better deal until he was elected? And hurt Carter when he was trying to clean up the hostage situation.
All right, thanks for the questions, Bill. Let's find out what Tim knows.
To your first question, I think no one knows the number of people, Vietnam veterans, who died early deaths because of drink or drugs or depression. The number you mentioned, 100,000, is certainly not inconceivable. We know today that our veterans come back home with wounds of body and soul and mind and spirit that may hasten their deaths. We understand that much better than we did back then. The second is Nixon's legacy in terms of what Reagan did is running secret wars with secret funds. Nixon used, by his own order, falsified records of the bombings of two neutral nations, Cambodia and Laos, that bordered Vietnam, but where the enemy had the Ho Chi Minh Trail running for resupply of their combat operations in South Vietnam. And Reagan used secret military operations and secret funds to fight the wars of anti-communism in Central America. Nixon's entire national security and personal team at the White House got indicted, with the exception of Henry Kissinger, and went to prison. And Reagan's entire national security team got indicted, but they were pardoned by George H.W. Bush, just as Nixon, in the end, was pardoned by his successor, President Ford.
So to come back to the large point here, though, Nixon actually managed to hold off peace in Vietnam through two elections then, both times promising, "I will end this war."
That is perhaps the darkest mark against his reputation. Against that, the horrors, the White House horrors, as his Attorney General John Mitchell called them. Mitchell later went to federal prison for his role in those horrors. Next to the dead and wounded American and Asian in Indochina, the break-ins, the buggings, the attempts to destroy his political enemies do pale in comparison. We're talking about body counts in the hundreds of thousands.
So you mentioned that that Lyndon Johnson, the president coming up to the election in November of 1968, knew. It was his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, running against Nixon. I assume he knew, too. Were there some difficult decisions made about not talking about what Johnson called treason that Nixon had committed with contacting South Vietnam?
Yes, because the crucial evidence had been gathered by the National Security Agency. It was too secret to discuss. And if you got into this claim and counterclaim about sabotaging the war on the peace negotiations on the eve of the presidential election, it would have ripped the country apart to a point where what followed in Watergate would have looked like a Tea Party parade. I don't mean that
in the Tea Party sense,
the
right?
Tea Party. I mean, let's say a cocktail party parade.
Okay.
They couldn't do it. The evidence was too secret. They debated it. It's all down on tape because LBJ taped phone calls, just like Nixon taped the entire White House and all his offices. Those were difficult days for our democracy.
Tim Weiner is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join him for the minutes we have left with him. His book about Richard Nixon is One Man Against the World, 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. Here's Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. I have so many questions and so many thoughts. I'm trying to zero this on down in terms of commenting on Nixon, the NSA, the secret security apparatus that was being developed at the time. Doesn't Nixon and the Nixon administration represent the consolidation of the CFR control of politics?
I can put it to you in a sentence, I think, Paul. Nixon wrote the book of Genesis for the Bible of the 21st century national security state.
So he really set things up for where things have gone since that time.
No question.
Let me follow up with Paul, see if you got more. Paul, is there anything else you want to add in there?
There'd be so much, we'd be here for hours.
Okay. Good to hear from you, Paul, as always. So Nixon and the way he dealt with foreign policy also led to an interesting set of circumstances with money from foreign sources for his campaigns, you point out.
Yes, Nixon tapped into a number of campaign sources, campaign cash sources. Just before the campaign laws changed, he got money from military dictatorships. He got money under the table from wealthy Americans who wanted to buy ambassadorships, millions and millions of dollars in illegal campaign funds, illegal under the law at that time, poured into the Nixon campaign. And what he didn't spend became money for in a slush fund that eventually financed the break-ins, the buggings, the dirty tricks that culminated in the break-in at the Watergate Hotel, headquarters of the Democratic National Committee in 1972.
The way you describe all of the dirty tricks, you get the sense that if it didn't happen at the Watergate, it would have happened someplace.
Their next target was the headquarters. Had they not been arrested, the Watergate posse, who were all washed-up FBI and CIA agents, Their next target was the headquarters of the leading Democratic candidate, Senator George McGovern, who eventually won the nomination. Despite what you may think of the powers of the FBI and the CIA, these guys were clowns.
It certainly sounds that way. It was a really, you know, Keystone copy kind of thing. I want to come back to the campaign money. With the relaxing of rules...
In the present day under Citizens United?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the kinds of things that Nixon did
perfectly... Right, by a 5-4 vote.
Mm-hmm. Oh, another 5-4 vote.
The deciding vote being Antonin Scalia. Justice Scalia tasted power for the first time under Nixon, who appointed him to the White House Office of Legal Counsel 40 years ago. Everything that would have been illegal then is legal now. As John Mitchell, the aforementioned attorney general and campaign manager for President Nixon, famously predicted in 1970, this country is going to go so far to the right that you won't recognize it. And that is part of Richard Nixon's legacy. Under Nixon served not only Justice Scalia, but the future Justice and Chief Justice William Rehnquist, who served longer as Chief Justice than anyone in modern times. Under Nixon came up Dick Cheney, who helped to dismantle the Great Society programs of President Johnson. Mr. Cheney became Chief of Staff under President Ford, and as you know, rose to become Vice President. Donald Rumsfeld, the same. Six secretaries of defense, six secretaries of state, all rose under Nixon. And interestingly, it is Dick Cheney, who again got his first taste of real power under Richard Nixon, who affirmed and reaffirmed the idea that the president is like a king in times of war and crisis. All the powers of the Constitution that are distributed to the courts and Congress gather in one man, the president, in times of war and crisis, under this theory. Nixon believed that. He said, and I quote, "If the president does it, it means it is not illegal." When he was fighting the Supreme Court, where he lost 8-0 in the decision that he had to turn over his secret tapes, his lawyer said, and I quote, "The president wants me to argue that he is like a monarch, like King Louis XIV, for only 4 years at a time," unquote. Well, we fought a revolution, we Americans, against that kind of government where a king decides everything. That's what the American Revolution was about. And One Man Against the World, my book about Richard Nixon's presidency, shows that we were in danger of losing those democratic principles because Nixon thought he was the king.
Tim Weiner is the author of One Man Against the World and our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange for a couple of more minutes here. So obviously a very long shadow because people who came up through the Nixon administration served in subsequent administrations as well and were highly influential. Is there any evidence that the men near Nixon, with the possible exception of that lawyer who was talking about Louis XIV, questioned the legality, at least in the early days?
There was a real question once the existence of these secret tapes were revealed. And a growing number of people, initially only four people, knew that the tapes existed. And gradually, as it became clear that Nixon might have to face impeachment in the House, a growing number of White House lawyers and other high-ranking staffers began to meet, apart from the president, and to say, as Nixon himself said twice, we ought to have a bonfire on the White House lawn and pile these 4,000 hours of tapes into a pile, throw gasoline on them, and then someone said, okay, who's going to light the match? King Timahoe? That was the president's not very faithful Irish setter.
Uh-huh.
Because anyone who struck the match, with the possible exception of the president himself, would have been immediately indicted for obstruction of justice. And Nixon, had he not resigned and been pardoned by President Ford, he himself would surely have been indicted for obstruction of justice. And that would have caused, we would have been in uncharted waters then.
Tim, I've heard this conjecture before, that in a world that now contains Fox News, a president like Nixon could weather the storm and stay in office. Do you think that that might have been the case if Nixon were president today?
It was Nixon himself who decided he had to resign. although clearly with poll numbers headed for the single digits, it was clearly the wish of the American people that he do so. The connection there is that the man who ran Nixon's brilliant television campaign in 1968, uh-huh. which surely got him elected, it was the first really, truly brilliant presidential campaign conducted through TV advertisements in 1968, now this is almost 50 years ago, was a gentleman by the name of Roger Ailes, who now runs Fox News. So there's your direct connection between Nixon's presidency and the Fox News of today.
And once again, the long shadow of people who came up through the Nixon administration getting into other influential positions, which they have held for decades since. One Man Against the World, The Tragedy of Richard Nixon, is the book by Tim Weiner. He's been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Tim, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
It's always a pleasure. Stay cool out there.
No, thanks. You take care.